Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for visiting. It's a hot day. It's been hot up here the last few days. I think it's just like a taste of things to come, perhaps. But well, thank you for making the effort to visit. And is it a couple of people's first time visiting? So, okay. I suspected as much. So, you know, this is on our schedule, it says this is the time for the Dharma talk. And in Zen, in the teaching of Zen, we look often perhaps at three major aspects. So Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So it's like three core ingredients of the practice here and at other Zen temples, training temples. This first word, Buddha. So we trace, in a traditional sense, and in a real sense, we trace our lineage back through different people, awakened teachers, in a lineage that goes back to the historical Buddha in India. So we could take Buddha in that way. And then if we look at his example, a key thing to bear in mind and to bring alive now is the meaning of the word Buddha. So Buddha means awakened one. So that one, that person who is awake. So that's what we put first. I'm going to read a koan, a Zen example, which also addresses this pivotal point, this awakening. So we have that Buddha to be awake, and then Dharma. So a Dharma talk, or a Dharma, you could say, is a teaching. And so you can have the context of a Zen temple with a teacher giving a talk, which is, you know, kind of what's happening here. You can take it in that way, Dharma talk. But then in a wider context, everything that is teaching, is Dharma. You know, it's an exotic sounding word, but it doesn't reside in one place. The Dharma, or the truth, the true teaching, is every waking and non-waking moment, whatever that present condition may appear as or look like, whatever the circumstances are, that is directly the teaching of reality. So we have awakening as Buddha, Dharma, awakening to the direct experience and teaching of reality as it is. And then this third aspect, Sangha. And again, in a narrower Buddhist context, we would say that is the group of practitioners, or the group of monks, and the group of lay followers. You know, maybe down through history, we've had that occur and still occurs now. But again, it's not fixed. We can really widen that out and see then Sangha as being everyone. You know, everyone, family, community. Doesn't have to stay on the human realm. All creatures, trees, all living things, all non-living things, all things all together, everyone, connected, interrelated, not existing in isolation or in separation, all things all together. So then the practice perhaps of Zen, we could say, is the experience of these three principles working together. Awakening, to the truth of reality. And if that is a true awakening, then it includes everyone and everything altogether now. And in this particular lens that we use here, we've continued, inherited, and found the value in traditional forms, which now disappeared forms set in motion into this present form, which has proven effective over these many years in guiding those with spiritual inquiry towards awakening. So then we have the robes and the bells and the incense and all of these things together. No value in any of it. No particular value in any of it. It's value where it serves to help precipitate awakening in people. That awakening is the finding of one's original self, who we are, what we are, before identity obscures that, obscures this. So I'd like to bring up a koan from our tradition, which I think is illustrative of what I'm pointing at. This is Ji Yen calls Master. The priest Zhui Yen called Master to himself every day and answered himself, "Yes." Then he would say, "Be aware," and reply, "Yes." Then he would say, "Don't be deceived by others," and reply, "No, no." Okay, so these cases were compiled many centuries ago. So there's part of this which appears difficult or very abstract. Some of that is some cultural stuff in there, the language, the names, that can seem a little different. But of course, what seems most irrational is the conversation the person's having with himself. You know, it's like, what is going on here? You know, but to look at koan, or to look at this case, we have to look at it with, we have to inquire into it, and to really inquire how this is reflective in our own experience. So the priest Zhui Yen, already an accomplished so-called, you know, perhaps whatever that means, accomplished Zen practitioner, someone who is, this is coming from the standpoint of awakening, called Master to himself every day. Really, that's enough of a koan to bring up. You know, when we look in this life, this experience that we are having, as my friend Ted said, the experience, the one that we're having now, the experience that we're having now, who is the master? It's a good question. I think who's in charge? Who is the master of this experience? So a common way we approach things as human beings is to live and always add and perpetuate the identified sense of existent self that is going through the world, doing things, interacting with things, with people, and living out a continuation of circumstances. And as human beings, the human beings that we are biologically and evolutionarily wired towards trying to build better circumstances and better conditions going forward. And we see the results of that out in the world, everybody trying to get theirs. You know, inherently, the Buddha really looked on who had it all, so-called had it all, on a material level. You know, the palaces, jewels, money, the, you know, all of those things that we might have, and yet found something inherently dissatisfying in that. And that's where is, you know, a rare creature in as a spiritual master, in that he already had these things and then yet decided that they were inherently dissatisfying. That you couldn't find satisfaction in acquiring things. So he set off on his journey of renunciation, looking for satisfaction, looking to put the mind to rest. There are many examples of this in Buddhist traditions, Zen tradition, and all spiritual traditions. You know, we see, perhaps, in our own life that if we only live through the lens of perpetuating this identity of me, then we're never at peace. Because there's always, it is always, by its nature, incomplete. We have that drive to want more. We have the drive to acquire. We have the drive to seek safety, whether it be in like money, health, relationship, whatever that is. We have that. It's a human quality. But, you know, the very reason to perhaps seek out any kind of practice or spiritual truth at the beginning is the knowledge, you know, that we have as human beings, which the dogs don't seem to be walking around with the spiritual angst of the trees, of knowing that on the level of form, it's an impermanent condition, you know. It's only going to be for a certain length of time, and then what? You know, the fact of impermanence of life and death. To know that no matter how we get things organized or whatever life that we're living, it can't be fixed. You know? It will all pass away. So turning, you know, looking at a tradition like Zen is to come to grips with impermanence and to see that that one that is always acquiring, seeking, and trying to right the ship of one's voyage is not the master. That is the human, just the human condition, the voice in the head. And that's not what he is talking about when he calls master. So that asks the question, you know, then, who is the master? Or mistress, or, you know, doesn't need to be, nor should it be gender specific. It's not about that. This just happens to be a man asking this question. He would answer when he asked that question, Master. Yes. So he calls Master and answers, yes. When we called, we answer. It's a natural response. It's a curious thing to even have a name, you know, we have a name. But is that who we are? Does that really encapsulate it? You know, we call, when someone calls our name, we respond. But it's a label. It's a label. It's something that we use. It's useful. We need, you know, it's, we need it to navigate life. But that label, that name, is not our original nature. So then what is our original nature? That's the inquiry of Zen, of the inquiring into enlightenment. To seek awakening. To realize Buddha, to be awake. So we could take the identified life that is always building and constructing this one and believes in all kinds of things, like a certain system of way that we should be living, whether it's a religion, a political system, etc., etc. And we can hold on to that and say, this is the right way, everything else is wrong. But if we can move away from that identification, and really look and penetrate, really inquire into what is this? What is this experience? What is this life? If we see beyond the veil of labels and identity, always, you know, creating separation, you know, our worship of dualism, feeling right about things, other people are wrong, we move away from that. Inquire deeper and really look, who are we then? The next line, he says, he would say to himself, be aware. Be aware. Or be awake. You know, this word I brought up at the beginning, Buddha, to be awake. This is what he tells himself each day. Be awake. What is he saying? What do you think that is? Where does that awakening reside? What is its quality and feel now? Or do we think that awakening is something that belongs to a spiritually enlightened being or somebody else? Or can we really experience and really realize that truth now, that this is awakening now? This is awakening. This is Buddhism. This is enlightenment. This is Zen. Be aware, he says. The whole, you know, our practice here, or the practice of Zen, is to be aware. We cultivate, cultivate awareness. When you come in, you join and you're told what to do. It's not necessarily a nice kind of guide you along kind of place, a Zen center. But rather, it is set up to disrupt one's self-fascination, one's addictive involvement with your own story, and rather tells you what to do. Like, this needs cleaning. This is, you know, this guest group that's in here, we're up here doing the dishes this morning or setting things up, and we've got to clean it all up. You know, it's a wonderful teaching. It is the Dharma. The Dharma of calling us to awareness. What needs to be taken care of now? And that doesn't always have to look like doing. It's not losing ourselves in some martyrdom toward work. What we call to be doing may just be doing nothing completely. Doing Zazen. You know, we just, wait for you that we're in here, doing Zazen. You know, I really encourage when you're sitting doing meditation, do nothing. Do nothing at all. Do nothing at all. The worst thing you can do is to continue to construct something. It's the opportunity to let the mind and body return to its original, unperturbed, peaceful dwelling place. To do nothing at all. That includes everything. But without the picking and choosing, without the preference, without the value system. Is be aware, be awake, whatever the activity, whatever it is that we're doing. You know, we get up from sitting and then we walk. And you have to be aware, because you might not, you know, for you guys who came for the first time, you don't even know which way to go, maybe. And then over someone else who's been here a while has to be aware that there are new people and they may need guidance. And other people need to be aware that of the time or whatever else is going on. It's nothing more exotic, this practice, than that. To be aware into what is occurring now. The more that that is obscured with, again, this self-fascination of what is going on with me and what I need to be doing and what I think about this, then so easily our real place in this reality is then obscured. And things are missed. The system starts to break down. What needs to be done? The dishes pile up. Be aware. And he replies to himself, yes. You know, and this is a Zen master. It's not about reaching the place of it's all goodness. And now there's nothing more to do. You know, there is the aspect of having nothing more to do. But that nothing more to do and accomplishment is always being at the place of dynamic action. Is always after being at the place of response. So that wherever you find yourself, wherever this place is always the right place. It's always the correct place. And what to do, the function of where we are, is comes forward naturally in correspondence with reality. It's our human picking and choosing of what to do with this reality that causes the suffering. We see that in the world, you see that in the country, in the planet, driven by acquisitiveness, greed, anger, and ignorance, we create hell on earth. And then hopefully spiritual retreats or places that are removed then offer a place that people can come to in a place of serenity and less confusion in order to return to what is most true, what is most real. Be aware, yes, you know, a caution not to fall into a place of I don't need to do anything now. That awareness that we are, you know, it's so easily obscured. And with any kind of accomplishment in this practice, then we have to be very cautious. Not to carry some sense of accomplishment or enlightenment, which we then bend to serve our own purpose. But to keep always inquiring. And when I say inquiring, not having to work it out, but are we aware of the breeze? Are we aware of the trees moving? The fan spinning? Words? Birds? The sound of the kitchen? That's where the practice, if practice exists, what it is now. Yeah. Often this self feels like it resides only here. But as we inquire and allow our sphere of activity to open, you see that the self, yourself, our self, this self is all things. When that's true, then you know what Buddha is, you know what Dharma is, and you know what Sangha is. And you can use the terms or you can throw them away. Don't be deceived by others. Not to be deceived. You know, we could be deceived by Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Deceived by some system of thought or belief, which we then take to be the truth. To be deceived. to come up with something which we think, yes, okay, now this is it. This is it. It's not this, it's this. Deceived by creating some duality, you know? To fall for something in one's own between the ears called the way or Zen or whatever else that it is. To have belief in anything at all is extra. Or, you know, maybe that's too harsh. You can have belief, but know it's a belief. That's what I'm trying to say. Not to be swept up in the belief that it becomes the truth. Well, I believe in this, but that includes other people who may not believe in this and may believe in something else. If it excludes even a hair in this world, then that is not awakening. And we're very good at deceiving ourselves. You know, it says deceived by others. Maybe we follow a voice on the outside. I like the Jukai ceremony when you get the rakusu and take on the precepts. It says, now, stop or cease following people of dualistic understanding. I like that line. It's like, now, just you gotta quit the dualism. Don't be deceived by others, to like follow something on the outside. And yet this other, the way that we create other two things in this world, is often an inverted process where we make that other here. We carry around this identified one. That's another way of being deceiving ourselves. Don't be deceived by others. And he says, no, no. And usually when these cases are written, if it says no, no, that's some extra emphasis. Yeah, not just no, but no, no, definitely no. Don't be deceived by others. I mean, there's more here. There's a comment, there's a verse. But maybe I'll just won't get into that, and we'll open it up for any questions or comment when anybody would like, if you want to ask something or say something, please do. It can be about what I've brought up or not. Yeah.
I like the incisiveness of just no and yes. There isn't really a here's a yes and here's a no. It's just a response. It includes everything. It's the yes includes everything, no includes everything, but the incisiveness. And also that even that has no identity to collapse. It can, but in reality, there is no identity in either of those to collapse into. It's just, this is what reality, or this is what to do right now in order to be free in a way. But always, there, either way, there's no collection of anything.
Mm-hmm.
There's a, it's a quality that I appreciate.
Yeah. And I just thumbed through the book before coming in, you know, and you look at some of these lines and the koans, and they'll be quite long, and various different interactions between people and principles brought up, and there's a lot you can say. But here it's just in four lines, and that's it. It's the entirety of one. It's like the entirety of practice.
Yeah.
summed up. Yeah, but yeah.
What does the word koan mean? Is it a lesson? You also use the word case.
Yeah. It has a few kind of implications. Koan can mean, the literal meaning was public document. Okay, so that reaches back into history here in China when the emperor said something or a local governor of some kind. A law decreed something, it would be written down and posted in town at the entrance into town. So it's like a public document. People saw that this principle needed to be paid attention to. So it has that quality. If this is a principle of Zen or a principle of reality to be paid attention to. Also, it means to make unevenness even, bringing things together in one place, one point. And really the role then of koan is to provoke doubt, or to help raise doubt. So if there's something here that you don't, it doesn't, once you get beyond perhaps the original difficulty of the language, you know, and you really look, then you may not understand it. And that might provoke, that provokes then some, well, what's going on here? And then it becomes a gateway to understanding.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Also, I wanted you to just say a little more about duality. You brought it up several times.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like you to define it. And
well, how would you define duality?
Good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
The opposites.
Right.
That's how I would perceive duality, or how I do.
Okay.
And go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that defines it.
Uh-huh.
Now, if we take either position as being intrinsically the truth.
Mm-hmm.
That tends to be, as human condition, we have a predilection to understanding the truth and only through that lens.
Mm-hmm.
We fall into one position or the other. Mm-hmm. We usually do it many times per day.
Mm-hmm.
Because we understand in a logical way, that's the way we're wired.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like how I came to practice or to Zen was through reading about quantum mechanics. And realizing, hold on, it's not one, zero, or one. It's not about this or that. You know, or you could say it's this, but it's also that. What does that mean? You know, so dualism is taking that fixing in one place in space and time, or in opinion, or in any kind of way, and cherishing that as the truth.
You could say judgment? That.
Hmm?
Would that include judgment?
Well, this is where it gets tricky. It's not about getting rid of judgment.
Mm-hmm.
It's in understanding that a judgment is judgment. Now, if you take judgment as being the truth, that's a problem. It's not about getting away from discrimination or dualism, but rather understanding its place or limitation in this experience.
So discernment.
And you end up saying maybe a lot.
Right, well, so discernment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe someone else would like to contribute to that too, but this is how I understand it. You know, even in the practice in that sense, or in Zen, you know, then we can fall into a dualism of enlightened versus deluded.
Mm-hmm.
They're just words. When they're useful, then we can use them. Or provisionally, we pick these things up. Thanks. Anyone else? Yeah.
I find of late that this idea of truth, from the time we're small children, our parents teach us, Johnny, always tell the truth, you know? And so you go through your whole life believing that you tell the truth, and then you get to a point one day when you realize everybody has their own truth. And you're living in a world and in a system where even if you come to your own truth within yourself, you have to constantly, seemingly fight every day against those people, other people who are trying to kind of force their truth upon you. So if there is really no truth and everybody has their own truth, how, as someone who follows a Buddhist path, how do we begin to live in the real world out there and still maintain our feeling of self or our self-truth in mm-hmm. relation to what all these other people are bombarding us with? That's what I'm stumbling with right now.
No, yeah, I understand. This. Yeah, yeah. Well, there's no such thing as the truth. Yeah. Truth isn't a thing. So, and there's no possession in it. So rather than people going around with their truth, maybe people are going around with their belief in the version of the truth. You know, so then each person's work or manifestation in the scheme of things is to inquire into what this truth is. In the only place where you can inquire into it, which is here, presently using this vehicle, body, room, whatever that it is. But more than that is you inquire, or with this inquiry, allowing that to open rather than getting lost, looking at how it is on the perceived outside, because that looks like a job of work, doesn't it, when you look at the world.
Is.
You know, we can be overwhelmed with that or discouraged. Rather, seeing what that is here, as this. And you see that truth has, there's no ownership in it. There's no, you can't find it. Or you can't find what it is not. You know, it can't be pinned down. We look with this present awareness. This is the truth. Really immerse in that, you know. You look in that, you immerse in that, and you see it's not a matter then of leaping in with the intellectual function and understanding then what this truth is that you've discovered. And finding that it's not matching very swiftly when you do that, it doesn't match anything else. I mean, for myself, it's rather the realization and trust, abiding trust and faith that this one, which appears as many, is always irrevocably in complete accord and perfection with everything else. It's for finding fault with that, which is the root of the problem. You don't need any greater truth than how things are. And what to do, how to respond, can function from that faith, from that understanding. Yeah. You know the truth is not out. The truth is not out there. Some from a TV show, anyway. Yeah. Anyway, thank you.
X-Files.
Right. Anything else? I'll read the verse. So it's an appreciatory verse. Students of the way do not know truth. They only know their consciousness up to now. This is the very source of endless birth and death. The fool calls it original self. So this is a comment on the case. Yeah, and maybe going on from what we're discussing. Students of the way, it's all of us, everyone, whether you call it Zen or not, do not know truth. Because you can't know it. It's not an objective experience. It's not a... You don't seize it. You don't find it. Students of the way don't know truth. You only know your consciousness up to now. We know the things we know. Now, if we build the truth out of that, that's a problem. Knowledge is just knowledge. This is the endless, this is the source of endless birth and death. This is impermanence in itself. Who I am, what I am, who they are, what they are, rising and falling. The very wheel of samsara, or impermanence. Is the source of birth and death, is knowing things. And he admonishes, fools call it original self. So we don't find it in things. And all that is required to really realize or understand that truth, you know. So this is where, you know, words are difficult and words mislead. Words can be pointers and they can be traps. But look here. You know, that's a key thing that I learned in practice. Is I learned where to practice. You know? I learned to look here. That's the one thing I learned. Where? Where to practice? Where to illumine? And as much as you allow, or we can allow our environment, what's going on, that is broader than this body. In, as much as that can be allowed in, then the conditions are ripened for realization to blossom. The more that it's wound tight and obscured with conditioned thought, the further away it seems. Okay, thank you. Thank you for listening, and we'll finish. Sentient beings are numberless.